Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Michael McFaul, author of From Cold War to Hot Peace, an American ambassador in Putin's Russia. I'm Bob Gustred. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Michael McFaul served as ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. That experience and many others in his many years as a Russian scholar is now embedded in the book From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. McFaul will be the keynote speaker at this year's Frank Church Conference here in Boise this coming Monday, October 14th at Boise State University. His keynote address is from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Monday night. That's October 14th at Boise State. Ambassador McFaul, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Ambassador, as a Russian scholar, you wrote a book titled Advancing Democracy Abroad, Why We Should and How We Can. You reference it in your book, From Cold War to Hot Peace, and you explain that democratic peace theory holds that the U.S. has a security interest in seeing the proliferation of democracies. How does this work into your work, not just as a political scientist, but more importantly, your work as an ambassador in Russia during your tenure there?
Well, that book I wrote right before I joined the Obama administration, and it was bigger than Russia. It was all of the world and 200 years of American history, but Russia fits in very prominently. Because I go through that history and I explain, you know, why Americans, not just presidents and secretaries of state, but why Americans have an interest in what happens with respect to democracy abroad. And I start with the argument that one's a moral argument. I agree with Winston Churchill that democracy is a horrible system of government except for all the others. And I talk about that we are a moral country, that we believe in values, and we have since our founding. And that in and of itself should be a good reason that we should support this kind of government. It's the autocracies that kill their people. It's the autocracies that starve their people. And if you look at the 20th century, millions of people died because of dictatorships, whether talking about the Nazis or the Soviets or Mao and the Chinese Communist Party, they're the ones that did all this damage to humanity. But secondly, as you rightly point out, I also think there's just a raw national security and economic interest for Americans to want to see democracy spread abroad. Think about it. Every enemy that we've ever had for most certainly the 20th century and 21st century, but even going back, they've all been autocracies. They've all been dictatorships, right? Who did we fight in World War II? It was the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians. They were all run by autocrats at that time. The Cold War, Soviet Union, Communist China, also autocracies. And if you think about it today, who are the countries that we are worried about the most? It's North Korea, Iran, Russia, China. What do all of those countries have in common? They're all autocracies. Conversely, our best and most loyal allies have always been democracies. Sometimes we've had autocratic allies from time to time, but they fade, right? Either they get overthrown, so they're not very good allies, or they change their minds because they're autocracies and they can't do that. And then third, as you pointed out, the political science, we don't have a lot of great theories, by the way. Let me be honest. I've been at it for 30 years. But one of our most robust findings, supported by lots of empirical data, is that democracies don't go to war with each other. Sometimes they go to war with autocracies, and autocracies go to war with other autocracies, but the most peaceful relations are between democracies themselves. So if you're just interested in peace and security, you also have an interest in seeing democracy spread around the world.
So another one of your books is Russia's Unfinished Revolution, and I'm not here to talk about that book, and I'm sure you want to talk about From Cold War to Hot Peace as I do. There's a section at the beginning that really catches the reader. It certainly caught me and got me through the rest of the book, where you relate what happened in the May 2012 meeting with President Putin. You're on a very, very short list, apparently, of folks who wind up in a meeting like this and end up getting, I'll call it scolded, to use a school term. Why don't you set that up for our listeners as to what's going on here? And the only reason I mentioned the title of that book is that I think somewhere in the book I read where you say that either Putin himself or his operatives actually used the title of that book to suggest that you were there in Russia to foment the revolution or to continue the revolution, whatever.
That's exactly right. I wrote that book in 2001, if I'm not mistaken, and it's an academic book. It's not a manifesto for revolution. It's a book that got me tenure at Stanford, by the way. I'm very proud of that book. But you're absolutely right. In fact, it was even the night before I reported to work my first day at the embassy. I remember it well. It was Martin Luther King weekend, so we had an extra day to kind of settle in our new house before I went to work on Tuesday. And that Sunday night, they ran on one of the television stations controlled by the Kremlin. They ran it was like 15 or 18 minute hit piece on me. And the commentator throughout the piece, right at the end, he said, back in 2001, McFaul wrote this book, Russia's Unfinished Revolution. It seems like, he's come back to try to finish the revolution. And that was definitely a theme that they developed to attack me throughout my time as ambassador. And like you said, including from time to time in person, Vladimir Putin would tell me that. And he would say, we know what you're doing here. We know what your objectives are. And, we're going to stop you. But I want to be clear, my objective was not to overthrow Putin. I mean, Barack Obama did not send me to Moscow to lead a revolution. This was complete propaganda, complete disinformation. And it was Putin's way of trying to mobilize his electoral base and to marginalize those people protesting against him, Russians, that we had nothing to do with. But that was just my fate that I landed in Moscow as the U.S. ambassador when he was in that struggle against the democratic opposition.
Well, tell us about the Reset Initiative of President Obama. You certainly were critical and key to that particular initiative. Could you please explain what it was, first of all, what Obama hoped to accomplish, and then secondly, I guess you could say, what went wrong?
The concept, the policy, was one that I was intimately involved with. I worked at the White House at the time. We did a policy review in 2009, and the idea, I think, was pretty simple. The idea was not to improve relations with Russia or befriend, back then, President Medvedev. Putin was the prime minister at the time. In fact, I strongly disagreed with those in the Obama administration that said we should try to improve relations with Russia. And that may sound, counterintuitive, but I had a firm belief, by the way, one of my mentors here at Stanford is a guy named George Shultz, who was Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. And this is the person I learned it from. When ambassadors would come in to see him right before going out to serve the United States, he would say, show me your country on the globe. He had this big globe in his office. And 9 times out of 10, they would point to Zimbabwe or India or the Soviet Union as to where they were going. And George would spin it back and he'd point to the United States of America. And he said, no, this is your country. Always remember you are going abroad to advance the interests of the United States of America. And I took that to heart, which is to say, we're not seeking friendship or hold hands and sing kumbaya with the Russians. We are seeking concrete outcomes, deliverables is the word they use in the State Department, that advance American security and economic interests. And we had a theory, and I think it was played out to be true, that in some instances, Russian interests and American interests overlap. And so if we could just engage through diplomacy with them on those narrow set of interests, that would make both countries better off. And I would say for the first 4 years of the Obama administration, the policy worked. We got a new arms control treaty, eliminating by 30% the number of nuclear weapons in the world. That was good for Russia, good for America, I think good for the world. We opened up a supply route through Russia to our troops in Afghanistan, reducing our dependency on Pakistan, and that allowed us to go in and kill Osama bin Laden in 2011. I think that was good for America, good for Russia, and good for the world. We got sanctions on Iran. multilateral sanctions on Iran back in 2010. And those sanctions, I think, were a necessary predicate to get the Iran nuclear deal, which, again, I think was good for America, good for Russia, good for the world. I think the president, President Trump, made a mistake in pulling out. We got Russia into the World Trade Organization, which I think was good for American companies and put them in a more rule-based system as opposed to being this outlier. That was during the cooperative period. You ask what changed, why did it fail? I think the answer is pretty simple. Vladimir Putin came back to the Kremlin, 2012, and right as he came back as president, there were these massive protests against him. So he became extremely paranoid about America, Obama, and me, ultimately, as the U.S. ambassador. And as one of the chapters of my book, it's titled It Takes Two to Tango. We were still ready to cooperate on some marginal things. Putin was not. And what can you do? And now I take great offense when people say the reset failed. I don't see it that way. I'm a big basketball fan, and I think about it as a play that we ran in the first half. We scored 40 points running that play. We came out in the second half, and the other side adjusted. They brought on some new personnel, in particular, this guy Putin. And then they shut that play down. That doesn't mean that the points we obtained in the first half were not good for America. And so I think all of those things we did in that cooperative period, we gave away nothing. We didn't check our values at the door. We didn't, do concessions to the Russians to get the START treaty or sanctions on Iran. But then when Putin came back to the Kremlin, we had to adjust.
You're listening to Michael McFaul. He is the author of From Cold War to Hot Peace, an American ambassador in Putin's Russia. Well, let's talk about Putin and see if we can get into his head here. And I'm sure you spent some time trying to figure that one out. I mean, there was a time, and you talk about this in your book, after 9/11, when George W. Bush and Putin seemed to be hitting it off. And then over time, thanks to at least three Bush moves in that era, things didn't go so well. One was the cancellation of the ABM treaty, the Iraq War, and the expansion of NATO. Does the expansion of NATO figure into what's going on in Putin's head in terms of how the West is trying to move in on his territories? I mean, help us understand. In 2012, you hit the ambassadorship, but at the same time, you're dealing with a guy, Putin himself, who just is looking at the world a lot differently than we are. Why?
Well, your last sentence is a key one, that he looks at the world a lot differently than we do. And I would say even than his previous president, President Medvedev. Medvedev was a younger guy. He was a lawyer, not an intelligence officer. And as we engaged with him, he saw the possibility of what Obama liked to call win-win outcomes, right? And we did several of those. Putin's a zero-sum guy. If it's plus two for America, it is minus two for Russia. That's the way he sees the world. And that fundamental different analytic framework means for a different kind of foreign policy. But I'm glad you brought up September 11th, because there was a moment, and I think we need to acknowledge it, that after September 11th, Putin saw al-Qaeda and terrorism as a common enemy with the United States. He reached out to President Bush, and I think that was sincere. And I think it was sincere on President Bush's side, too, that he wanted to find some common interest in fighting, back then we called it the global war on terror. And there was a period of time after September 11th where we were on that track of cooperation. And I give credit to President Bush for realizing that common agenda with Putin. But it ended in part because of NATO expansion. So you're right about that. That happened the year after. The Big Bang happened right after that. And that annoyed Putin. There's no doubt about it. It was a policy that he did not support, especially when NATO was expanded to the Baltic countries. I think it was the right decision, by the way. I want to be clear about that. But it's also true that it annoyed Putin. It exacerbated tensions. But the real set of events that I think knocked our cooperation in the Bush era off the rails was color revolutions, so-called color revolutions in Georgia, a country that used to be part of the Soviet Union. And that color revolution was in 2003. And then Ukraine, the Orange Revolution in 2004. And that really got under Putin's paranoid skin, because in his view, the United States of America, the Bush administration, the CIA in particular, and remember, Putin's a KGB agent. He's thinking, he's always thinking about the CIA. Mm-hmm. He thinks they can do incredible things. By the way, they can do incredible things, but they're not nearly as powerful as Putin thinks they are.
Right.
But in those cases, he thought that we were overthrowing regimes that were on his borders, and we were promoting democracy in ways that he thought were not in Russia's interests. And so I really think those events were the ones that ended that period of cooperation.
Let's talk for a moment about 2016, which, of course, when it comes to Putin and his suspicions as far as the United States is imperialism, as he would call it, we're looking at 2016 election. We're looking at Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State, and she issues principles of engagement with Russia. What were those, and why did they really, you might say, get under Putin's skin and cause him to go to work on our election?
Well, you need to go back to December 2011 to understand this story. And so I'm working at the White House. I'm not ambassador yet. There are parliamentary elections in Russia, not presidential elections. And there's falsification there, kind of, I would say, normal levels of falsification, nothing surprising to us. And what we used to do then is issue statements about whether elections were free and fair. This is what the Obama administration did about a lot of elections. By the way, the Bush administration did it. It's just part of diplomacy, right? Supporting democracy and human rights. And Secretary Clinton made a statement. I remember it because I cleared it on behalf of the White House, right? I approved it on behalf of the White House. It didn't seem very surprising to me. She just echoed what the European electoral observers had noticed in that election, that we saw irregularities in the way that this election was conducted. But that statement, because there was this new protest movement in Russia, really got under Putin's skin. In fact, he had Medvedev call Obama. I was on that call. I used to be on all of Obama's calls, by the way, with Russians, given how who's on the call and who's not is in the news these days, just so you know. Medvedev said very bluntly to Obama, he said, "Does Secretary Clinton speak on behalf of the Obama administration or not?" And he was really worked up about this, what I thought was a pretty innocent statement. And I just think that underscores just how paranoid they were about these massive demonstrations happening in Moscow at the time. And so I think that when 2016 rolled around, Putin decided, aha, Clinton messed around in my elections, according to him. I'm going to now do the same to her. And I think this was his moment of revenge. They had the means to do it. And whether it affected the actual outcome of the election, I think that's a debatable issue. There are lots of factors involved in terms of President Trump's electoral victory. But were they trying to influence the election to undermine Clinton? I think that's clear as day.
Well, you have some great examples that, frankly, I had never heard of before regarding the interference. I mean, we all know that they interfered because we listen to the news. But the specifics, I wonder if you could just help our listeners understand what the Internet Research Agency was and what the Senate Intelligence Committee uncovered, both during the 2016 election and even afterwards, as late as April 2017. This agency was still at work on Facebook and other social media, fomenting demonstrations of one kind or another.
That's right. IRA, the Internet Research Agency, is an organization set up by a close ally of Putin. And they'll always want the alibi, oh, this isn't the U.S. government, it's Mr. Prigozhin, the guy that runs it, is close, very close colleague of Putin. So it's a distinction without a difference that it's somehow an independent NGO. And what they do, just like you said, is that they are on Facebook, they are on Twitter, they're on all kinds of social platforms, Instagram, and they're out there as trolls and bots propagating disinformation, number one. So things are just blatantly not true. But they're also exacerbating tensions in our society, right? They're amplifying things that are already there. and particularly they're focused on racial tensions in America and kind of playing up on both sides to create and to deepen polarization that we already have here. I think that's their central strategy since 2016, but also included in 2016. And in addition, there are two other pieces that I think need to be remembered to have the full picture. So one is that organization out there trolling, and you know, people like me too, by the way. You know, they're constantly attacking me on Twitter and Facebook. But then there's two other pieces. One, the Russian military intelligence, it's called the GRU, they stole data. They stole information from the Democratic National Committee, from John Podesta, the head of Clinton's campaign, and then they published that data, right? That's called doxing. That's the new verb that's been invented out here in the Valley for it. And that had a huge impact on the way that people thought about Clinton back in 2016. Negative impact, obviously. And then third, there's just the more classic stuff that they do with their television program, Russia Today, their information organization called Sputnik, and other entities. But those are the two key ones where they're just out there, you know, they're on cable. I don't know if you get them in Idaho, but, you know, they're part of my cable package here, Russia Today. And they're just out there pushing, you know, disinformation in much more classic ways. And you might think, well, who would ever listen to this propaganda? It's silly. And when I look at it, it seems pretty silly. But RT Today is one of the most watched channels on YouTube in the world, in the English language. They surpassed CNN. They surpassed Fox. And so I think we as a country, and we as the free world, by the way, I would include our Democratic allies, just have been in kind of asleep at the wheel about propaganda coming out of Russia. And I think for us to protect our democracy and to push back on this disinformation, we really need to think about it much more systematically.
Where does that happen?
Right now, it's not happening. I mean, there are some good people within the government thinking about it. And I should say, at companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter, they have been more proactive in trying to take down what are obviously government. And it's not just the Russians, by the way, it's the Chinese and the Iranians in this too. They're more proactive in that. I want to give them credit. Since 2016, they've learned and they've taken some of these operations down. But I think it'll require a more whole of government approach. You know, not unlike, tragically, what we did during the Cold War when we thought about how to push back on communist ideas. I think we need a kind of grand strategy to contain, deter, and provide alternative sources of information to what's coming out of the Kremlin today.
You're listening to Michael McFaul. He is the author of From Cold War to Hot Peace, an American ambassador in Putin's Russia. I'd like to talk for a moment about your years as the ambassador and what seemed to me from reading your book a balancing act that you were forced to engage in, a tension, so to speak. On the one hand, I got the impression that these State Department bureaucrats, these lifelong career ambassadors, oftentimes go to countries and blend in with the local culture, stay out of trouble, be careful what you say that could be in any way interpreted as critical of a regime. On the other hand, you come to your ambassadorship with a wealth of knowledge and expertise about Russia, with some books which we've already referred to, your scholarship, and at times, either before or during your ambassadorship, at one point during your ambassadorship, you were invited someplace and somebody tipped off folks that you were going, and before you know it, it was a big demonstration against you.
Right.
But I guess where I'm going with this is help our listeners understand this, because I never really thought of it much before reading your book. You're not the classic diplomat. And I mean, that is the ultimate compliment in this particular case. Not that I don't have respect for classic diplomats, but you did come at your job a little differently. And that was something that wasn't in the playbook of the Department of State all the time. Am I overstating that?
No, I think you're right about that. Obviously, I was a political appointee and I didn't move up the ranks of the State Department. But I was a rather unique political appointee. You know, most political appointees who are ambassadors get the jobs because they give money to campaigns, right? And that's with right. Democrats and Republicans, by the way. Mm-hmm. I think I gave $250 to Barack Obama, so I didn't get my job because of my, you know, support for his campaign. You know, he sent me there because I am or was an expert on Russia. And, you know, a lot of career diplomats, just to be clear, when they show up in Moscow, they also aren't experts on Russia. A lot of them don't know Russian. They're coming there for the first time, their first assignment. And I remember one of my first staff meetings, there were people in the room, because they're younger than me, who had read my books to educate themselves to take this job, right? So I was a unique ambassador in that regard. You're right. And to your question, it's a hard question. I want to emphasize how hard it is to do that balancing act. Because on the one hand, you are there as a representative of the President of the United States and the U.S. government, and your principal task is to engage with the Russian government to do things. And so you can't be scolding them all the time and then trying to do business with them the next day. But on the other hand, we had a policy, the Obama administration, of speaking out about violations of human rights. And we had a policy called dual track engagement, which was that we were going to engage with the government, but also with societies. And that was true all over the world, but especially true in Russia when I was there. And so when I was doing those things, I thought I was carrying out the policy of the Obama administration, where we had sat in the White House Situation Room and decided this is our policy. And I had the added advantages that I was there. I was literally there while those policies were being decided in 2009. So I didn't have to second guess what the policy was. I helped to write it. The challenge was things got worse while I was there. Putin cracked down on the demonstrators. He arrested a lot of people. Russia became more autocratic during the period that I was there. And, you know, at a certain point, you have to make a decision. Are we just going to pretend that this is not happening? Or are we going to speak out about it? And I remember, I write about it in the book, there was this moment that really crystallized for me. It was the National Day for Russia, June 12th. And on June 12th, the President Putin holds a big reception for all the elites in the country, and ambassadors are invited. And I was at that reception, and I had just said something critical about the government. And I could tell many people were avoiding talking to me because they did not want to be photographed with me and this anti-Putin guy. And one of my friends, remember, I've been living in Russia since 1983, so I know a lot of these people I've known for decades. I met Putin in 1991. This was not my first rodeo as ambassador. So one of my friends came up to me and said, you know, you realize that you really pissed Putin off with that comment. And I said, yeah, I know. And I was feeling kind of bad about it. And, you know, I felt like, you know, literally the skunk at the tea, whatever that phrase is, you know, nobody wanted to talk to me. And I walked out to my car, and as I got closer to my car, you know, my car has a big American flag on it. And I was looking at, you know, that came more into focus against the backdrop of the Kremlin walls. And it reminded me of other times when other ambassadors and even journalists didn't talk about what was really going on in that country, especially during Stalin's time. And in the name of getting along, ignored some horrific things that had happened. And that was that moment I just decided I'm not going to be one of those people. And if it means that Putin throws me out of here, so be it. We just cannot ignore injustices. And I tried to do it diplomatically. I tried to, you know, not offend people. And most certainly, on the day-to-day business of diplomacy, I had people that worked very closely with me. This is something that the Russian propaganda doesn't want people to know, but I had, you know, very good relations with lots of people in the Russian government. But I was never willing to say, okay, I'm going to check my values at the door. We're not going to, we're going to kind of be quiet about these things so that we can get on with business. And I just think in the long run, that's not serving America's values or long-term interests.
Well, one of the reasons you give in the book as to why you pushed back on this anti-Americanism and these anti-democratic Russian policies is that there were Republicans back home at the time who were attacking Obama as being too soft on the Russians. And you don't have to respond to that necessarily. My real question here, and this is the last question I get, and we've just about run out of time. Where are those Republicans today? I mean, the Republican Party has always had a strong platform that was very belligerent as far as Russia was concerned. And I mean that seriously. Where do you go in the Republican Party today to find the same tough approach to Russia that you experienced when you were there as ambassador?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I do know, like you said, the Republican Party has a history of being tough on communism, of being pro-democracy and freedom and liberty. Whether you talk about Ronald Reagan or going back to Eisenhower or George W. Bush, I mean, that was always a rock-bed principle of Republican Party thinking. And, you know, 2014, the year I got out, came back to Stanford, I remember I was on Sean Hannity's radio show, and he was berating Obama for weakness and why are we not tougher on them. I can tell you, I watch enough Sean Hannity these days to know that he's changed his position on that 180 degrees. I mean, I think the explanation is that the president himself, President Trump, has a different approach. He believes that, you know, he wants a good relationship with Putin. And going back to our earlier conversation, it's my impression of the president today is that he puts a good relationship with Putin as the goal. And he doesn't think about, you know, the concrete things that would be good for the United States. So he's kind of mixed up the means and the ends. I can tell you that most people that work for him and have worked for him, I have lots of friends who used to work in the Trump administration. A couple of them are here, you know, working with me at Stanford these days. The administration as a whole actually has a pretty, I would say, get tough approach towards Russia, at least has in the past. But the president doesn't agree with it. And as a result, I think public figures, you know, members of the Senate in particular, who know better, are not articulating and are not speaking out because they don't want to be on the other side of President Trump. And, you know, I just think at some point you got to put country over person. You know, I have the oath of office. I keep it on my desk. The one I took is a U.S. ambassador. And it says to defend our country against enemies, foreign and domestic. It's right there. It's not an oath of office to Barack Obama. It's an oath of office to the United States of America. And I hope that someday we'll get back to a more normal time when everybody understands that at the end of the day, we're all Americans. We have American national interests. We don't have Republican, Democratic national interests. And especially when it comes to our big adversaries like Russia, they don't think of us in those terms. And God forbid, if we ever went to a war and a missile from North Korea or Iran or Russia or China, you know, landed on California or Idaho, that missile is not going to discriminate between Democrats and Republicans. And I think we need to come together as a country and realize that when it comes to national security, you know, we can debate about other issues, and that's healthy and normal. But when it comes to national security, there isn't a Democratic and Republican perspective on that. We have been at our best historically when we've had unity on those issues. And, you know, I hope someday we'll get back to that.
A fitting conclusion to a book that is a must read for anybody who cares about the direction this country is going. It's From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia by Michael McFaul. Ambassador McFaul, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Michael McFaul will be the keynote speaker this year at the Frank Church Conference here in Boise. That's Democracy in an Age of Anxiety, Russian Intrusion, Chinese Confrontation, and Populist Disruption. It starts at 8:30 a.m. on Monday morning in the Simplot Ballroom, and it concludes that evening with Ambassador McFaul's keynote address from 7 to 8:30 in the Student Union Jordan Ballroom. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.